Welcome to Answering the Call with host Elizabeth Ficicello. In this program, Elizabeth gives us a glimpse into the spiritual journeys of priests, deacons, and religious sisters and brothers from the Columbus Diocese who have heard and answered God's call. And here's your host, Elizabeth Ficicello.
Hi, and thanks for joining us on Answering the Call here on St. Gabriel Catholic Radio, AM 820, and streaming live on stgabrielradio.com. I'm your host, Elizabeth Ficicelli, and in this program, Answering the Call, we get to meet some of our priests and our deacons and our religious sisters and brothers in our diocese and learn about their particular faith journeys as they've listened to God's call and pursued it in a vocation for a church. And, you know, the role of deacon has become a familiar one in our church. As Catholics, we've come to accept and even expect the deacon to be serving alongside the priest on the altar every Sunday. But there was a time a few short decades ago when the vocation of permanent deacon did not exist in our diocese, or in the modern church for that matter. And my guest today, Deacon Roger Pry, remembers those days well. He was the first ordained permanent deacon for the Diocese of Columbus, and he's here today to share his very interesting story with us on Answering the Call on AM 820. So welcome, Deacon Pry, and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Now, Deacon, your story is interesting right from the beginning because you were not raised Catholic.
No.
So tell us a little bit about the family you grew up in a little town called Crestline, Ohio, and how that gave you your first foundation in God and faith.
Well, Crestline is a small town in Crawford County, about 5,000 people. There was one street with about four or five churches on it. One of those was the church of my baptism. It was First English Lutheran Church. My mother's mother, that side of the family, were all Lutherans. And as a result, all of my grandmother's grandchildren grew up as Lutherans as well. And we attended church every Sunday. Sunday school was a part of the weekend. As I grew older, I was involved with the church choir, youth group, and so forth. My parents, weren't overly strict with religion. Like, we didn't have daily devotions or anything like that, mm-hmm. but we were expected to go to church on Sunday and Sunday school on the weekends.
Okay, and comfortable relationship with God growing up.
Right,
and,
right.
Now, your first inclination to a life of ministry began in high school when you saw an impressionable movie. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it was my junior year in high school, and my girlfriend and I went to a movie in Mansfield, and it was called A Man Called Peter. It was a story of a Scottish minister. He's from Scotland, but he came to the United States and felt the call to ministry and studied for the ministry in the United States. And he was a very good preacher. He ended up being the chaplain of the Senate in Washington. But the story of his life and his sermons on the movie and all that really touched me. And I felt afterwards maybe God was calling me into some kind of ministry in the church of which I was a member.
And in your senior year of high school, you had the opportunity to further explore that possible ministry as part of a school project.
Right. Our senior English class, all of us had to do a year-long, you might say, term paper in which we did research on what we had hoped to do when we got out of high school. And so I chose the ministry. And so as a result of that, I did a lot of reading, met with a lot of ministers of different denominations. And during that whole time, I think the feeling of being called into the ministry even grew stronger, to the point that when I graduated from high school, I had already enrolled in a church or college of my denomination with the intention of later on going into their seminary. It was Wittenberg College.
In Springfield.
Yes, and at that time they had a seminary called Hama Divinity School that eventually merged with the one at Capital University here in Columbus.
And you had a field trip, I guess that was still in your high school years, to New York City, and that also sparked some curiosity in you.
Yes, it is. It sounds like I was really interested in New York to see some churches that I had seen on movies. One was St. Patrick's. I could never remember this movie and seeing this gorgeous church, and I'd never knew there was anything like that around. So that's one thing I wanted to do. But I also wanted to see the Cathedral of St. John the Divine, because it was an Episcopal cathedral, but it was the largest, one of the largest church structures in the Western Hemisphere. And then there was this third little church that, one of the ministers that I had talked to in my research was an Episcopalian priest, and he told me about this church in Manhattan in the Times Square district. Called St. Mary the Virgins, and he said, you probably wouldn't want to go there because they use incense, and it's very Catholic, and I said, okay, but that was the first one I visited when I got there. I was so curious. I'd only been to one Catholic Mass in my life before this, and I thought this was exactly like the Catholic Mass I'd gone to, except it was in English. This was in 1956, so...
So which one of these churches, you said one of them was Episcopal, that seemed very Catholic.
Yes. In fact, they would call themselves Anglo-Catholics. Okay. And this particular church, and my wife and I were in New York about 14 years ago, and I wanted to show it to her. It didn't look one bit different than it did in 56.
Still preserved.
It had everything I knew of what a Catholic church would have. It had confessional booths. It had holy water. The priests were a member of some religious order of theirs, so they were celibate. There was nuns. And I actually picked up a pamphlet in this church on how to pray the rosary. So that was my first experience with the rosary.
So it sounds like then this experience was piquing your curiosity that there were Protestants that were acting very Catholic,
that's
so
right.
to speak. So much so that you wanted to continue your research somewhat informally and talk to a Catholic priest about it. What were your intentions at the time?
The intention at the time was just to find out more. I was just interested in, I didn't really know a whole lot of what the Catholic Church believed at that time. But I liked the ritual and all that stuff. And the church that I had grown up in at that time would have been called a low church. They didn't have a real high liturgy. I loved the church, by the way. I'm not. But that's what first got me interested. And then when the priest was very good. He had me come in twice a week and went through the whole. He says, I can give you a short version or I can give you the same instructions I'd give a convert. Which one would you like? And I says, well, I'll do the long version. It was, I guess God was working in all on this. And this priest was very good. I'm sure he used the Baltimore Catechism, but he didn't allow me to memorize any answers. I had to answer every question, but in my own words. And I think that really helped.
And what was the result of this session, these sessions with this priest?
What happened was that I fell in love with the sacramental life of the church. I felt, well, I had a good background, by the way. I had to go to catechism for 2 years before I could be confirmed in a Lutheran church. So I felt like he added on to what I believe, especially with the Eucharist and the real presence, the way it's defined in the Catholic Church. I think that was the thing it grabbed me first.
And you were 18 years old.
I was 18, yeah.
And you made the decision to enter the Catholic Church.
Yes, I did.
That's a pretty remarkable and radical decision. How'd your family respond to such a thing?
Well, they weren't real happy in the beginning, but they got used to the idea and had no problem with it after a while.
Had you ever been raised with anti-Catholic sentiments growing up? Because I speak as a former Lutheran myself, and I had my fair share of that. So I was wondering, was that true in your case?
Well, sure. It was kind of the idea that Catholics could be your friends, but you don't go any farther than that, you know.
Right. Very cautious around.
But that was, you know, this is back in 56. And it was most of what I had been told about the church from different relatives was just a matter of not really knowing, you know.
And living in such a small town, that Crestline little town, With the four churches, was one of them Catholic, by the way?
Oh, yes.
Okay. Yeah. So everyone kind of knew what was going on, probably, yeah. right? Because they all kind of knew you.
Yeah, a little Catholic church. By the way, last year at the Super Bowl, the dad of the two coaches went to that church. He was in a year younger than me in high school.
Wow.
Jack
so put
Harbaugh.
It on the map
yeah.
now.
yeah.
We're talking with Deacon Roger Pry. He's the deacon at Pope John, the 23rd Parish in Canal, Winchester, and he's our guest today on Answering the Call here on St. Gabriel Catholic Radio, AM 820, and I'm your host, Elizabeth Ficicelli. So, Deacon, I would imagine that the discernment to join the Catholic Church would throw a bit of a monkey wrench into your plans of pursuing the ministry of Wittenberg.
Right. I knew that I wanted to be married and have a family. And so that kind of just had to be put on the back burner. I didn't really, at that time, feel there was any place of ministry for me in the church. This was pre-Vatican II, so there really wasn't a whole lot that lay people could do. Okay. So
what did you do in terms of college, in terms of marriage?
Well, I ended up... since I knew that ministry was not, at that time, I didn't think that was a possibility. I wanted to do something similar, and so I thought I went to Ohio State with the intention of teaching high school, actually. But eventually, I switched to elementary school, and so my bachelor's is in education, master's is in education, and I taught for 30 years.
And you did start a family, got married, mm-hmm. start a family, children?
I was married. My wife, Charlotte, was the organist of our church, by the way, in Crestline, and then eventually here in Columbus. We had four children, and in 1969, she was diagnosed with acute leukemia, and back in 1969... there wasn't a whole lot that could be done for it. So she lived about 10 months and then passed away. So,
and that was a time of great transition for you, I'm sure, and your family. Let me go back for a second. And you had mentioned that you came into the church prior to Vatican II.
Mm-hmm.
And you also had said in the beginning of the interview how you were really drawn, as far as the Episcopal Church, to the kind of the external trappings of that
right,
Episcopal
exactly.
Church, the ritual
yeah.
that was attractive to you. Were you concerned that the Catholic Church was going to lose some of those externals because of Vatican II? And did that concern you, or were you able to embrace those changes?
No, I didn't. No, I was ready to embrace them. By that time, you know, especially after I took these instructions from this priest that year, that I really was, I knew that it was the teachings of the church that was really important. The other part made it beautiful and all that, but that was not that's not the main reason I came into the church. It was because of the teaching of the church, and especially on the sacraments.
Now, as we were talking about the transition in your life, obviously you had this big transition in your family life. You were remarried shortly after
mm-hmm.
To Midge, who's actually joining us in the studio mm-hmm. for moral support today. And there was also some other transitions going on the church in general, something new on the horizon, and that would also have a profound impact on your life. And I'm talking, of course, about the restoration of the vocation of permanent deacon, which was first approved by Rome in 1967 and then by the U.S. bishops in 1968. The Diocese of Columbus had not yet started a diaconate program in those years when you first became interested in this. Tell us how you became interested in this brand new diaconate program.
Well, I think it was actually shortly after I joined the church. I read an article in probably the Catholic Digest, somebody speculating that this might be a possibility, but I didn't know what a deacon was, but it was out there. And then a friend of mine, we graduated from high school together, and he had one time thought he was going to be a priest. But he, too, was drawn to married life, but had kind of this feeling like me that there ought to be something for us to do. So together, we were kind of aware of what was being discussed in the Vatican Council. Because even before it was approved, we knew that was in they were discussing it. And then 1967, when it was approved, we both talked about it and hoping, well, maybe someday it'll become a possibility for us. But again, we were just kind of speculating on what might happen. And then what happened is the Toledo Diocese, that's my hometown is in Toledo Diocese. Now, it's only about an hour from my home where we lived in Columbus at the time, but it was Toledo Diocese. They started their first diaconate program in October of 1972. And my buddy told me about this, that he was going to be a part of it. And one thing led to another. I thought, well, maybe I could go up there too. And I did ask the vocation director at the time here in the diocese if he thought it would be okay. And he said, yeah, I think it'd be okay. So I did. And didn't realize at the time I should have probably spoken with the bishop first. And that was just pure ignorance on my part.
Well, everything was so new. You were in such uncharted waters. You know, most deacons that have interviewed for the program have talked about the serious discussion that needs, for instance, to take place between their families and them about this big commitment they're about to embark on. You know, and most of us today have a pretty good idea of what a vocation to the diaconate might entail. But back in those days, you and your second wife, Midge, couldn't have possibly known what to expect. So how was that discernment process for the two of you and your family?
Well, you know, I know, but before we, Midge and I even officially announced that we were going to get married, I had mentioned this to her, the possibility that that might happen, and could she accept that, which she said she could. Now, even with that, we weren't aware of everything was going to happen in the future, because as you said, it's uncharted waters. As I look back, she was the one sitting in the pew with my kids, and I was the one up in the altar. And but she never complained, and it's been you couldn't ask for anybody more supportive than she's been with me in this whole thing, and the kids too.
And they, how old were they when you were going through the formation process?
Our youngest was, well, we had just had our first child. I had four by my prior marriage, and we had our first child. She was born in September, and I started classes in October.
Oh, boy. Okay. So you had the baby at home.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And you did this training through the Diocese of Toledo, like you said, and it was 2 years at that
time. At that time, it was 2 years. With, you know, 2 years, we'd go for weekend, Friday through Sunday, where we had classes, and then there were assignments that were made. At that time, back in 1972, and there weren't lay formation programs out there, so what we were getting was much more than the average parishioner would have. Now, that wouldn't go today, but back in 1972, it was adequate. You know, they kind of gave us a little bit of everything that the priest would get, but just little snips of it, you know.
Right. Yeah. And with your career path, which was education, teaching, you didn't have like philosophy and theology, any kind of background. Did your Lutheran catechism come into play at all? Was some of that helpful in becoming a Catholic deacon?
Well, yes, because the Lutheran catechism is based on the Apostles' Creed a lot, the Luther's Small Catechism, which, you know, gives you, when you study the same, like the Apostles' Creed and the Lord's Prayer for 2 years, you learn quite a bit from that. Yeah, that had a lot to do with it. I did have some philosophy, you know, you had to have philosophy of education and introduction to philosophy. So I didn't, it wasn't that I didn't have any philosophy, but it was through Ohio State.
Now, tell us how, even though you were trained in the Diocese of Toledo, you would become ordained for the Diocese of Columbus. How did that come about?
Well, that was an interesting story, because my classmates were ordained in 1974, June, I think, in 1974. And at that point, I didn't even have a clue whether I was going to be accepted into the Diocese of Columbus or not. But I talked with I can't remember who the vocation director was at the time, in the summer right after that. And at that time, the diocese was beginning to form their own program and started recruiting people. And I had my pastor at St. Augustine was Father Earl Holzapfel. He was there for so many years that they used to call him the Earl of Linden. But he was known by his brother priests to be, you know, a by-the-book guy and real kind of a German stern. But he was so supportive of me from the very beginning that I think that actually impressed some of the other priests of the diocese and maybe helped them become more willing to look at this new vocation and be and have it be introduced in the diocese. So by the fall of 72, we actually had our first, or 74, we had our first group of deacons that were being trained.
But you yourself were ordained.
I was ordained because I was finished. Bishop Herman agreed to ordain me, and I was ordained on the Tuesday of Holy Week in 1975. It was March 25th. And I was ordained a deacon along with three other men who ordained deacons who are now priests.
Right. So they were making their transitional deacon vocation. You were becoming the first permanent.
Yeah.
How interesting is that?
It was funny because when they had to make the promise of celibacy, I had to sit down. But then afterwards, one of the priests said, "I saw your foot on the carpet." So I.
That's funny. So there you were, the first permanent deacon ordained for the Diocese of Columbus. So what was it like being in such a pioneering role? How did people receive you?
Well, the people in my parish seemed to receive me quite well. You know, I never felt that I wasn't accepted. And I think a lot of that had to do, again, with the pastor I was working with and how he was so supportive. And also, I was always able to function in all the diaconal roles, preaching, baptizing, weddings outside of Mass, and so forth. So and that was a real blessing for me. But again, you know, I was back in those days, you didn't have anybody to compare yourself to. You know, the only clergy that we were familiar with was the priests, and so we had to kind of find our own way. And one of the big things they cautioned us about in those days, I don't hear it too much anymore, is that, remember, you're not a mini priest.
Right.
And that's so important because we're deacons.
That's important
in itself, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
I think those two misconceptions, either a mini priest or a glorified altar server, it's not either.
Yeah.
And thankfully, you know, today I think most Catholics now have a better understanding of what a deacon does. But since you have such a unique perspective on seeing the diaconate program grow from its very first years in our diocese, you know, 38 years later, looking back, how has the program changed and evolved, and what kind of deacons is it producing today?
Well, I think the deacons are much better educated than we were, because they have to be in today's church. When they're coming into a vocation, they've had others to look at as mentors, examples, and so forth that we didn't have. And I think because of that, the roles have grown. For example, our bishop is at different times appointed deacons as administrators of parishes while they're between a priest assignments and those kind of things. Now, that was not even would ever been thought of back in the early days, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So
little changes here and there, tweaks to the program.
Right, yeah. And we have, and most deacons are still, you know, they have a full-time job, but there are some that have, they have full-time ministry and still have an assignment in a parish as well.
And it's nice to see it to be such a growing vocation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're growing so many more deacons. And, you know, I was thinking as I was writing up my notes for this interview, the priest guests we've had on the show refer to their fellow priests as brother priests. The deacons we've had on the show often use that expression, my brother deacons. And I was thinking, does that make you like the big brother of all the deacons?
I don't know.
I'm sure they must turn to you, look up to you.
Well, I've never been called that. I've been called a few things, that's not one of them. What is that, archdeacon or something like that? But You know, there's so many deacons now. You know, when we started out with just a handful, now I don't know, we're approaching 100, I think, in the diocese,
wow.
Maybe even more.
Thank
I'm
God.
Not sure. And there are, you know, guys that have applied for the program, and it just, you know, they don't even, maybe they don't have room for them. I think they only take a number of candidates at each for each class, but there are plenty of vocations out there to the diaconate.
Tell us real quick, you told me a story about where the diaconate, kind of the restoration of it, evolved from.
Well, what I read, this was by a deacon who did his PhD on this, and back in during World War II, it was in the prison camp of Auschwitz that the priests were arrested along with everybody else, but and they would continue to try to proclaim the gospel, and the people running the prison didn't care for that, so they put all the priests in one spot in a block, a priester block or something they call it. Well, in that, the priests got together and started discussing ways that maybe we can do a better job of reaching the people and proclaiming the gospel. And one of the ideas that came out was having married men ordained as deacons. And
amazing.
They kept notes, and they wrote those notes down. And then those were taken, actually, from what I understand, to the Vatican Council, and was a part of this.
An amazing story.
Yeah.
Deacon Roger Pry, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your beautiful story. If you could leave us with your blessing.
Heavenly Father, we ask you to send your blessing upon us. And may your face shine upon us. May you be gracious to us and give your blessing. In the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Amen.
Amen. Thanks again.
You're welcome.
God bless you all, and
well, thank you.
I hope you'll join us next Saturday at 10:30 and Sunday at 4 for another edition of Answering the Call. This is Elizabeth Ficicelli, host for this program on St. Gabriel Catholic Radio. I'm a Catholic speaker and author of 14 books for adults and young people, including Where Do Priests Come From, Where Do Sisters Come From, and Where Do Deacons Come From. You can visit my website, elizabethficicelli.com, for more on that. In the meantime, you have a great week. I look forward to introducing our next guest next weekend. God bless.
If you know a priest, deacon, or religious sister or brother that might be interested in telling St. Gabriel listeners how God inspired him or her to answer the call, please contact us at info@stgabrielradio.com.